You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
So I eventually led to a point where I ended up meeting an individual. He says he was involved in that recent shooting. The Zetas attacked me, and I was arrested with possession of an explosive device. He goes, well, I was in my armored vehicle, my escort. We were attacked, and one of the RPG rounds hit the car and entered the glass and did not explode. And he was inside the vehicle. So therefore, when the cavalry showed up, they arrested him because the RPG had not exploded. So he was in jail. He was very confident that he'd be getting out.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA special agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Thank you so much for coming back every week. Truly could not do any of this without your support. So appreciate you guys coming back. Got another fantastic guest today. He touches on an area that you've never heard me talk about. He's a former DEA agent. You know I'm joking, right? Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun today. Been looking to get this guy on for a while. I met him through a mutual friend a couple of years ago. This guy's a 27-year veteran law enforcement professional. Spent the last 23 years as a DEA special agent. 4 years with the sheriff's office in Virginia, which we're going to talk about a little bit. I love this part because when he got hired on the sheriff's office in Virginia, his last name's Hispanic, but he said his Spanish really sucked. And I think that's why they hired him, because they wanted him to speak Spanish, but he's proficient now, let me tell you. He is also an advocate for autism awareness, and we're going to discuss that as well. Plus, he's the author of a children's book about autism. And the name of the book is Alejandro and the Bacon Breakfast. That's Alejandro and the Bacon Breakfast. You got to check it out. We're going to talk more extensively about that shortly. But here's the cool thing. I was going to save this, but I'm going to tell you about this now. In 2024, that book, Alejandro and the Bacon Breakfast, was taken to the International Space Station. One of the few children's books that's ever made it up to the space station. And our guest today is the author of that book, Chris Diaz. Chris, welcome to Game of Crimes, brother.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you. I'm getting, just talking about your book, I'm getting goosebumps here, man. That's fantastic that you're taking the time to bring awareness. And we're going to talk a little bit more about your family here in just a few minutes, but this is going to be good today, everybody. So listen in. If you haven't seen us on YouTube yet, do me a favor. If you listen to this, go over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, hit the subscribe button, check out some of the episodes. Check out Chris here, nice looking young man here. He says he's retired, but he's really not, because none of us ever retire. You've heard my saying, just because we retire does not mean that our oaths expire. And Chris is living up to that as well. So go over there and join us on YouTube. The channel is growing here recently. I'm not sure why. Actually, I do know why. It was Tony McBride was a big kickoff here. But Tony, love you. Thank you very much. By the way, we're going to have Tony back on later this year. She's already agreed to another interview, so you don't want to miss that. But let's get to today's guest, Chris. So, Chris, give us a little bit of a – well, first of all, let's talk about how you and I met. We have a mutual acquaintance.
Yes.
What's that guy's – well, we can't say his name, can we?
No, not right now. I've known – I call him Q. Okay. He's reminiscent of the James Bond's right-hand guy with all the technology. And at the end of my career, when I was operating overseas, he's part of the U.S. Marshal Service. And he was always ever present. And he's from an area of California where the flat brim hat and everybody whitens their teeth and they have the perfect smile, riding skateboards, probably drives a VW bus. But he is incredibly savvy with technology. And I believe he went out to dinner with you at the gang conference.
Right.
And that's where you guys ended up chatting up, and he was sharing some tales, spinning some yarns about what we were doing before I retired. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that we're going to get into some really interesting stories today, ladies and gentlemen. And one of those that I'm going to save for a little bit later, but Chris did something in DEA that I've never heard of anybody else ever doing in DEA. So you certainly don't want to miss that. I don't know if we'll get to it today or tomorrow, but I'll tell you right now, Chris has already agreed that this is going to be a two-parter, if not a three-parter. So we'll see how this goes. But Chris, if you would, tell us about where you grew up, your family dynamics, brothers, sisters. Did you play sports in school? Did you go to college? That kind of thing, please.
Yeah, right on. I was born in Florida. My dad was a naval officer. His family's from Mexico. He's first generation in the United States. And he was literally born in East LA, like the song. And my mom is Irish-Russian, and she's from New York. And so she was also a naval officer. They met in Spain during Vietnam. My dad was stationed over there, and they ended up getting together, had a family, got married. And through that course, when I was born in Florida, my dad was assigned to it's called the Mill Group at the U.S. Embassy in Caracas, Venezuela. And so our family, which at the time was mom, dad, my brother, and I, we ended up moving down to Venezuela. We spent about 5 years in the late 70s and came back in 1980 to Virginia. And we moved around to different areas in Venezuela and then back in Virginia. Grew up on the beach and spent the majority of my younger life there. I went to college, James Madison University, go Duke Dogs.
There you go.
Yep. And then I went to school for music, ironically, and that's probably the only way I was able to get in. And I went to school for music, and then I realized music wasn't for me. I tried to go into the Navy. The Navy had an officer candidate school program at the time where I followed my dad's footsteps. And my math was not good enough. So they actually mean it when you have to write out the problem. You can't just guess and get that answer, especially if you want to fly jets. But
I hate that part.
Yeah, math is important. But from there, I studied sociology, minored in criminal justice, and I decided to pick a profession that paid less than a music teacher to become a police officer. And I was picked up by the Albemarle County Police Department, and it used to be a sheriff's agency, and they became a police department, but we worked in the county. And in the middle of Virginia in the Shenandoah Valley. And Charlottesville is the city inside the county. No, it was a great ride. I learned a lot there. I was one of the first Hispanics in the police department. I believe the only ever at that time. And you're right, my Spanish was terrible. But I would carry around this little cartoon book, a police Spanish book. It was just made of cartoons, and I would actually get calls for service. I would roll up and they would recognize that it was me. And because I worked in the rural area, the more agricultural side, and people would say, I remember there was one domestic where people actually stopped fighting and we all gathered around a picnic. It was a fisticuffs and people stopped fighting because I showed up and I had my blue book. And then we went to like domestic violence, assault, simple assault page. And then there was cartoons. So I would read out what the policeman was saying, and then they would point to what their specific perspective was. That was wild.
That sounds like you really de-escalated a situation.
Yeah. When you can't talk to anybody, is it the only way you need to do it? Draw pictures. Well,
when you finished with the book and the pictures, did they go back to fighting?
No, by that time, everybody had relaxed. People would laugh at my Spanish, and that in and of itself would de-escalate.
Yeah.
what was going on. But over time, you start doing the same repetition. As a police officer, you're dealing with domestics every day and speeding tickets. And so you just start to memorize by rote leading.
Charlottesville, the home of the University of Virginia.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And many wannabe attorneys. That was...
I got to go to a DEA leadership school there at UVA. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the best schools ever, a 3-day school. Got to go in the old tower there at the part that burned down, I guess part of the library section there. Mm-hmm. And they took us out to Thomas Jefferson's house.
Yep. That was actually in my beat at one point. We would rotate around with that, but yeah, right across from Thomas Jefferson's house, there's an orchard at the top of the mountain, and you can see the entire valley. It's gorgeous.
That's beautiful area of our country here. Where did the interest from in law enforcement come from? Was that something you'd always thought about, or did you just thought, well, I'm not going to do music. What could I do?
I did music. I happened to be good at music. I played trombone and I played jazz and symphonies. And it was just something that music just kind of ran in the family. And I was not a good student in high school. I had a lot of struggles with that, which now I learn I have some dyslexia, which comes out when I'm tired. Right. And so I had a very difficult time with academics, but music carried me through. And so when I put in for school, that's what opened the door for me. But all my life, I wanted to go into the Navy, but I also had this fascination with or influence by watching the TV show Chips and with Eric Estrada and playing Poncherello and being being in Virginia, in a rural area of Virginia. Even Virginia Beach at the time was fairly rural when we got there, and we were the only Hispanic family on the block, and people would call you Ponch. I would just kind of lean on that. Plus, I like Magnum PI. He was an investigator, and those two shows kind of geared me towards law enforcement. But I wanted to do military first. I wanted to be like my dad. And so when that didn't pan out the way I wanted it to pan out, I decided maybe I'll be a cop and then see what happens from there.
What was your specialty? What kind of specialty did you want in the Navy?
No, I wanted to fly. So the way the testing was set up at that time is you would test for the general officer entry exam, and then you would test for flight aptitude. And I did very well for the flight aptitude, but I did not do well. I took it twice, and two times I did not. I missed it by 1 point, and it was based on my math, and you had to show out your math.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, it kind of worked out for the citizens of the United States by going into law enforcement here.
Yeah.
When you were with the sheriff's department, did you do any narcotics cases or undercover?
No. When I was with the police department, I was the uniform guy that I would get called to do the traffic stops. And in that area is the Joint Area Drug Enforcement, the JADE Task Force. And there was one time where I actually met it. Like, we would meet the FBI, that those guys would get stopped by us, and we would let them go. But we, you'd always hear about DEA, but nobody ever met a DEA agent. And I was asked to participate. I remember the reason why I don't know, you may know him, Kirk Clements. I don't know if you.
Yeah, I do know Kirk very well.
Okay. So I was asked to be a translator, and by that time I was able to muck my way through conversations and help out on a translation level. Kirk Clements was, I believe he was assigned to Richmond, a DO, and he was working with Jade as the DEA counterpart in Albemarle or Charlottesville. So Kurt had a warrant, but it was outside of the Albemarle County jurisdiction. Now in Virginia, in that time, it was very, if you will, very centralized. Like, your jurisdiction was where you are at. Like, you don't leave and you don't operate outside of your jurisdiction.
Right.
And Kurt, because that narcotics team allowed them to float around Virginia, they had a warrant in a neighboring jurisdiction. And so they said, come on, Diaz, you're coming with us. So I roll out in my uniform. And I remember driving up Afton Mountain. We're going over an area called Waynesboro. And on the driver's side is a guy named Danny Board. And he later went into FBI and became a bigwig there. And then there's Kurt Clements. I didn't know who Kurt was, but here's this guy. He's got a mullet. He has this military type hat on, and he has navy blue or black BDUs, but it was crisply ironed, and he was in shape. And I'm like, oh my God, like that's a DEA guy. And I said, guys, as we're driving up the mountain, I said, I don't think I'm allowed to go outside of our jurisdiction. And so Danny goes, what do you think, Kurt? And Kurt Clements turns around and he does this. And I was like, well, what was that? You just blessed me? And he goes, Danny goes, no. He just deputized you. You can go outside. And I'm like, the chief's going to be okay with it? And he goes, of course he is. He just deputized you. DEA just deputized you. And so we end up crossing over the mountain. We end up going to this trailer park. Kurt's having me translate an interview. And, during it, mind you, like Charlottesville is fairly liberal, and the judges were liberal. And so I had an incident where someone had assaulted me and they only got 6 months in jail. And that was a good sentence. And so Here we are interviewing, and I'm helping translate the conversation between Kurt and this target. And Kurt's asking the same questions, like, do you know who John Doe is? And the individual says, no. And he goes, no, tell him that's BS because I have his phone number right here and he's calling John Doe. And so I'm translating this and I said, well, and he goes, and you tell him if he doesn't admit to what's going on, he's looking at 10 years. And I stopped and I said, 10 years for what? And he goes, for conspiracy. I said, conspiracy? So I ended up almost being like this guy's defense attorney because I didn't understand. I couldn't wrap my head around these federal charges for 10 years. And then after that interaction, I knew I had to join DEA. Because if you're getting 10 years for a phone call, can you imagine what you would get for assaulting an agent or being on the border and moving drugs? Because drugs is always interesting. This is a cat and mouse chess game, et cetera. It's fun.
Well, had you ever seen the TV show Miami Vice?
Oh, yeah, Miami Vice for sure. But for whatever reason, that didn't attract me as much. I don't know. Maybe it's the sleeves rolled up with a suit jacket. I don't know.
And that was a style. Yeah. That was a style back then. They were doing that in Virginia Beach.
Did you do that?
Not in dress like that. I did watch the show, though.
Right on. But that's how I got into DEA. It's all Kurt Clements' fault. And ironically, when he retired, he was literally in the building in Houston. It was my last tour of duty. And he was there. I got a chance to see him and point my finger at him every day. It's because of you.
That was the last time I saw him. He was still in Houston. I think he might be retired now.
Yeah, he's retired, and he's off in the oil and gas industry.
Good for him. I mean, you just never know. And it's strange how certain things pique your interest. When I was a city cop in West Virginia, then a railroad cop, and I didn't know what DEA was. And a former Virginia State Trooper came along and was a railroad cop with me. Got to be best friends. Pete Ramey, still love that guy. And he started telling, he was on the DEA task force in Roanoke and started telling me stories. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
When you joined DEA, did you know that DEA agents work undercover? And did that appeal to you, or did you not even know about that?
Well, I kind of knew a little bit about that. Like the undercover that I was aware of at the Albemarle County Police Department, it's the hand-to-hand transactions working with the task force. Someone would get assigned. And at one point, there was one officer who graduated from the academy, had previous experience, and we had a captain who's former FBI. So he tried to implement a UC program with this one individual. And then that individual lived off the grid in a trailer trying to see who's doing local thievery and seeing kind of what's out and about in town. That's kind of what I knew about undercover. Other than what you would see in the movies or television shows.
Did you think the job with DEA was going to be undercover? You know, and just to follow on to that, did you learn anything very quickly that you thought, man, I didn't know it was going to involve this?
When I was a police officer, I remember it was Halloween and I was writing a report because we are customer service oriented and somebody wanted a report taken because their pump-ins were smashed. And so being a public, you know, that area, you would have Sissy Spacek owned a home there and Howie Long owned a home from the Raiders and he does all those Super Bowls. And that was in my beat at one point. So you do some customer service report writing. And so I just remember sitting there thinking, man, is this what I want to be doing for the rest of my life at times? And I just kind of wanted to be jumping out of helicopters. And then the more I started being in the DEA hiring process, you do a little bit of reading and you see the cool photos. And that's kind of what I wanted to do. And going through the DEA Academy, you start learning about undercover. And then that was pretty interesting. They would have instructors talk about their personal experiences, which is pretty dope. And I was thinking, oh, I kind of like that. Yeah. You know, I did, I've been in a movie, a Silence of the Lambs sequel. It's called Hannibal, and I enjoyed the acting portion of it, of being an extra, but being an extra in a lot of interesting scenes, pretending to be law enforcement. And I was like, man, this could be something real, like in real life, like the way the feds do it, like the way they do it in the movies.
Was this movie thing, was that while you were with Albemarle County?
When I was with Albemarle County, I ended up getting injured in a pursuit and my car slid off a gravel road and I hit a tree. I kind of saved my life, the tree, because I would have tumbled down this ravine and I broke my collarbone. I was in the hiring process with DEA. I had a separated collarbone and my buddy, who worked in Henrico, we were college roommates. He says, hey man, if you got a chance, come on down. I think I can get you in this movie as an extra. We could just hang out and drink beer all week. So like, yeah, right, whatever. So he took like the little cop baseball cards and I was accepted in, and then we ended up hanging out, drink beer all weekend. And I was able to get in the movie and he is, only his right ear got in the movie. So
pretty funny. You stole his scene. No,
yeah,
no.
Pretty much. Yeah.
So how long, when you applied for DEA, how long did it take before you got hired?
That's a good question. It took 3 years.
Oh my gosh. It was a hiring freeze, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I joined the Albemarle County Police Department in 1997. And I didn't get hired. Like the day I stepped foot in the DEA Academy was March 23rd, 2002. And I ended up, DEA called me. They said, if you're interested, you have to be here on Saturday. And I think I had 72 hours notice to show up at the Academy. And so, I was able to work my way into that. 3 years.
That's the longest I've heard. 3 years. I was 2 years and it would have been much longer. I took a chance and drove from Southern West Virginia to Washington, D.C. to the WDO, to the district office there in Washington, and asked for the recruiter who just fortunately was in the office, a guy named Charlie West. And Charlie's like, he came out, he's like, do we have an appointment? And I said, no, sir. I just applied over a year ago. I haven't heard a word from you guys. I'm just curious. And he said, so you drove 6.5 hours just on the chance that I might be here? And I said, I did. He said, are you okay? I said, I want a job. So he went back and he comes back and he says, okay. He said, I found your application. He said, I promise you it's now on top of the pile. And it was, I mean, it processed from there. So,
well, congratulations. You just, all your luck of the lottery right there. Just want, the fact that you were able to get with the recruiter.
That's so true. That's
wild.
Because I just go drop a $2 bill down now and I would never win anything. Although we did win $7 last week. So But I bought 10 tickets. So it was $20. That's kind of a law enforcement mentality when it comes to investment. Spend 20 to win 7.
And you still feel lucky about it.
Oh, me. What was going through the academy? What was your wish list? Where did you want to go to after the academy?
So I again, from Virginia, moved around, military family. The mindset was, is wherever Uncle Sam wants to send you, you go. I was just happy to have a job and to get through the academy. As much as I was given the opportunity to come back to the police department if for some reason that it didn't work out with DEA or whether it's an injury or I just didn't cut the mustard. And so I was happy to get through the academy. So when the list came out in the very beginning, there was a lot of infighting because the way they set it up, it was very challenging. And then people were crying, you know, that they can't move here, they can't move there, but everybody signed a mobility agreement. So that I had my parents' mindset is like, hey, if you were given a spot, you just take the spot. So I volunteered to take a spot on the border. And again, going back to my time with Kurt Clements, like if this is what we're doing in Virginia, can you imagine what they're going to be doing on the border? This is the best. So I just selected Laredo, Texas, and which is one of the largest land ports of entry into the United States for legitimate merchandise and drugs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if you knew that, but Javier used to be a deputy there.
I do. I ended up meeting Javier later on in my career after leaving Guatemala. But we talked about that. It's pretty cool.
So you, I think you spent 7 years down there. Is that right?
Correct. In Laredo, Texas, 7 years. When I was given the position and I ended up meeting one of the old heads out of Richmond, DEA guys, And he says, what did you do? Did you make a mistake at the academy? Like, why did you put in? And I didn't completely understand what he was getting at about going to Laredo. I said, no, I volunteered for it. I want to be at the tip of the spear. And he says, oh, you're going to be at the tip. All right. And so looking back on it, that is 7 years. That was a rough, very, very challenging, work intensive time. But I wouldn't trade it for the world. The amount of work, repetition, case management, caseload was just unbelievable at that time. And so I wouldn't change it for the world. The connection to Mexico, dealing with other offices, phenomenal.
What a great learning experience. And rather than certainly not knocking smaller offices, but I started out in Miami in 87. It was still the Wild West. And for a small town country boy to go to a place like that and get to experience the things that you get to experience, it's an experience of a lifetime.
Unbelievable. The most drugs at the time before I went to Laredo, Texas, was 25 pounds of marijuana on a kitchen table. And that was unbelievable in that part of the country. Go down to Laredo, Texas. I was assigned as a drug evidence custodian to manage the drug warehouse as one of many other custodians. And the warehouse had over 100,000 pounds of marijuana in it. I mean, it was bananas. Like the amount of marijuana that was left on the floor after taking your mandatory drug samples from the bundles was more than I had ever seen as a police officer. Yeah. And that's what you literally swept off the floor. It's a completely different world.
Yeah, it sounds exciting, but dealing with that amount of weed is just a pain in the butt, isn't it? So,
especially when it spoils. I remember one time we had a load and it was in chili powder, like hot pepper, chili powder. And so the canines identified it, and it was probably 1,000 pounds of weed, but it was all encased in these bags of chili powder. And so your hands were burning. It's like being pepper sprayed, like your full body was pepper sprayed, and you had your whole team out there. And of course, you have rubber gloves, so your hands are sweating. So then the powder gets on into the sweat, and it gets into your pores because all your pores are open. Man, that was But that was part of the experience down there. It was wild.
That was a memorable experience, obviously, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned Guatemala. Is that your next stop? How did that come about? Did you volunteer to go there?
I did. Let's see. So while in Laredo, Texas, we ended up, my partner, who's still on the jobs, his nickname was Comandante Pelos. He loved his hair. So we worked together and we ended up doing a case and he was from Laredo, and we did a case, and it was on a group. It was called the Zetas when they started coming around and being more proactive. And that case led into a very interesting operation. It's called Operation Prophecy, and where the Zetas were utilizing teenage sicarios.
Whether it's slots or live dealers, SpinQuest.com has the fun and action you're looking for with SpinQuest exclusives. Blackjack, roulette, baccarat, and even live dice with craps and bubble craps. The games never stop, so you don't have to. And right now, new users get $30 coin packs for just $10. Play now at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
And those teenage sicarios were floating between Nuevo Laredo and Laredo, Texas, on behest of the Zetas, and killing a lot of people. And that case ended up going into a book called Wolf Boys. And so from that investigation, we were able to get arrest warrants against one of the leaders of the Zetas. And from there, I was able to go into Mexico, TDY, temporary duty in Monterey at the consulate, to talk and give presentations on the information that we had gathered through that investigation and methodologies. And then from there, I ended up going to Mexico City, sitting in some meetings that I had no business sitting in. You know, there was no, at that time, it was wild. And then from there, I ended up meeting the CA, a guy named Mike O'Brien, who is the CA of Guatemala. And I was asked to go down there, and I TDY'd down there. And while I was there, I was able to give some briefings to they had a United Nations group with a lot of people from Madrid, who were giving mentorship to the Guatemalans and talking about the Zetas, because the Zetas were creating inroads. Even though they were the enforcement arm of the Gulf cartel, they were creating their own inroads through Guatemala. They committed a massacre. And then from there, they were trying to go into Honduras to get a direct line to Colombia for their own transportation route, which was leading more towards their own separation. And that eventually led to a war between the Zetas and the Gulf cartel. A battle conflict. So through that engagement of working with the Guatemalans, that allowed me to develop relationships in Guatemala, where when a position opened up, I was able to take the opportunity and throw my name into the hat, and I was selected. So
you'd made a name for yourself.
Yeah, a little bit.
That's a good thing. It's that's how I got in Colombia. I was doing some cases with the office at Barranquilla. And they get to know you, and they know they can trust you. And then when your turn comes, they vouch for you.
Yeah, that's for sure the truth, the vouch. Yeah.
Now, you were telling me in our pre-call about a case that you were working down there on pseudoephedrine. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because that was pretty significant.
Yeah. So when I first got to Guatemala, that was in 2009. And prior to that, with a lot of work with SOD, SOD provided amazing assistance with the Guatemalans, and they developed legislation to make pseudoephedrine illegal. The Guatemalans did. Guatemala was at that time the beach landing point for pseudoephedrine, which would then be trafficked by way of land. And it would be taken from Guatemala to Michoacan, Mexico. And why is that important? Well, during that time, pseudoephedrine was the precursor chemical for crystal methamphetamine. And Los Caballeros Templarios at that time, they were the ones running and taking the charge for methamphetamine production. And so when the Guatemalans made pseudoephedrine illegal, that's what led my adventure in Guatemala. So when I arrived, my boss brought in a stack of paperwork about this high, and then he put it on my desk, and he says, you said you like to investigate. Well, I want you to investigate this. And so I started reading all this data and all this infrastructure, and then there were old CIs. Me and one of the guys, one of my old partners, we ended up sitting down and we identified some people to talk to, and we were able to identify who was the leader who was involved in the pseudoephedrine importation or receiving it, and then funneling it to Michoacan, Mexico, which opened a big can of worms, which eventually led to my being threatened and having to leave Guatemala.
And where were those proceeds? A lot of the proceeds were going within Guatemala that led to these threats.
During that time, it came to our understanding that a lot of the organizations that were operating in Guatemala, the drug trafficking organizations in Guatemala, they also had legitimate businesses where they were laundering their monies through, and those businesses were getting government contracts. And through those government contracts, they could launder their money as long as 25% of the money that the contract was bestowed upon, those monies had to be deposited into very specific government charities. And those charities would be utilized in order to help fund certain political aspirations or to continue political aspirations.
Yeah, right at the top.
Yes, right at the top. Yep.
You're being very diplomatic.
Yeah, I'm trying. At that time. So I eventually led to a point where I ended up meeting an individual, and that individual who was intimately involved. That's actually a funny story too. He ended up calling me. He called DC. DC routed him to my telephone, and off of that telephone call, I just remember walking my dog outside of the apartment, and you could barely hear him. It's kind of scratchy telephone call. And he's like, he says, do you know who I am? I said, I don't know who you are. And he gave me his nickname, and he goes, no, I've been in the news recently. I was like, okay. He goes, I'm in jail, but the charges are BS. My attorney said I'll be out of here. I said, okay, well, what happened? He goes, well, I was involved in that recent shooting, the Zetas. Remember, they were having inroads into Guatemala. The Zetas attacked me, and I was arrested with possession of an explosive device. And I said, okay.
That's good.
I was like, okay. I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, I was in my armored vehicle, my escort. We were attacked. And, one of the RPG rounds hit the car and entered the glass and did not explode. And he was inside the vehicle. So therefore, when the cavalry showed up, they arrested him because the RPG had not exploded. So he was in jail. He was very confident that he'd be getting out. So I told him, I said, okay, if you get out of jail, and I was familiar with that event because that made the news. I said, give me a call and we'll talk about it. I never thought I would ever hear from him again. And then about 2 months later, I get a call and he says, I want to meet up with you. I have a lot to tell you. So I said, okay. I talked to my boss and we got money, went to a hotel, and the guy showed up and he was wearing, I don't know why mullets are such a big thing. He was wearing a mullet wig. cowboy hat. He had a brown shirt with the pearl buttons, you know, and he had a fake mustache glued on his face. And I was like, what is going on? And he's like, I had to ride the public transportation. I wasn't going to take my car to meet you. You kidding me? But he had a stack of papers, and in those papers were all the government contracts that his people were, that he was aware of, that people in the drug trade were laundering their money. And he had the, if you will, the bona fides of that concept of that drug trafficking organizations were laundering money through government contracts. So yeah, that's how it began.
I was going to say only in the third world country, but it'll happen anywhere around the world. Would a man, somebody try to kill somebody and the RPG grenade did not explode, the rocket, and they charged that man with possession of explosives?
That's bananas. It's been, you know, and back then, like, this is another concept that was really foreign to me. Like, if you get in a shooting, they arrest everybody involved. If you get into a car accident, they arrest everybody involved. Jeez. Until the matter is resolved. That was wild.
That's unheard of, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That wouldn't float here in our country. But you're not in our country.
Right, exactly.
You ended up picking up threats against you in Guatemala. Now, is your wife and child with you, or who's with you?
So at the time, I was married and still am. God bless her heart. She's been through a lot.
That's our unsung heroes, brother.
Yeah, that's for sure. And so the target that I was investigating with regards to the pseudoephedrine lived three city blocks from the apartment complex I was at. Jeez. And he ran multiple city blocks. Like, you could drive down there. I was told not to go, but I went with our Foreign Service National that was assigned to us. They did take us. They just said, hey, lean down in the back, drive through these neighborhoods. And you can see guys walking around armed to the teeth, and not wearing a uniform, private security, but it was obvious that they dominated that area. And so that individual lived three city blocks away. and so I, having my wife there and obviously picking up those threats, not just me, my partner, and his name was Guy Galuccio. We worked together in Guatemala. We actually went to language school together. It was great, great family. Lived in the same apartment building. And we had multiple CIs, confidential sources in that organization, reporting that could actually go talk to the boss. And so upon receiving those threats, Guy Galuccio and I, we were tasked with investigating the threat against ourselves. So to make sure that was valid. And so that required us to go into the territory, drop off the CIs and have that recorded, the threat and what they wanted to do to us, which is funny that here we are under the threat. And then we ended up having to go in there to make sure that it was real. It's pretty wild.
That's the way we do it, DEA. Yep.
That's right. But we were able to confirm it. And once upon confirmation, we followed policies and procedures, and we were able to get out. And my partner went over to Peru, and I ended up, was able to make my way to Puerto Rico, and Claudia came with. My beautiful bride.
Did you want to go to Puerto Rico?
No, I wanted to stay overseas. In fact, I was originally offered Mexico City, which is very cool. But being that the individual that we were investigating at the time, it was an alleged threat to pick us up, was tied in to the Michoacan. And since we were doing the investigation, that's where the pseudoephedrine that had became illegal was being shuttled to Michoacan, going from Guatemala to Mexico City. If there was any information, like, how was this information coming out about us specifically? It'd be like going from the pot to the frying pan, potentially. And so chose not to go. I wanted to stay in the foreign environment. And then instead of going there, I was then offered to go back to Laredo, Texas, which I didn't want to go back to Laredo, Texas, wanted to stay foreign. And so Puerto Rico was kind of like a let's meet in the middle. And I had to make a lot of phone calls to make that happen, believe it or not. And then once that got accepted, my partner, great partner, Janelle Boggs out of 959, she worked the pseudoephedrine case with me. And through that, when I was primarily evacuated, I went to 959 so we could do our proper case. And there was more involved with that case beyond pseudoephedrine. But we were able to work together at SOD and get warrants, go to the Eastern District of Virginia. And then they, you know, we were trying to work the ability to have him arrested in Guatemala. And then from there, she and her husband had connections to facilitate me being able to go to Puerto Rico. And I was happy to go to Puerto Rico, still speak Spanish, improve on that, stay in the foreign environment, working international type cases. And that's what I very much enjoy doing.
Was that guy from Guatemala, was he eventually arrested?
He was eventually arrested and he was brought to the United States and is in prison. My old boss did talk to him and ask him if he threatened, had any feelings of doing harm against federal agents. And he said no. So
not a bad guy that lied. Come on now.
No, it's impossible. Unfortunately, while I was at SOD, I ended up finding out that one of my CIs that was fantastic. He ended up getting picked up and he ended up getting murdered. And I was advised that it was a simple robbery. How that's deduced, I don't know. A lot of broken bones and left with a little bit of cocaine in his pocket and having a watch on his hand and et cetera. You would think those are items of value that would probably not be left with the body on a simple robbery.
Right.
But that also happened. And that's something that stays with you.
Yeah, it does. That's not something that, you know, CIs, you kind of trust them at arm's length, but at the same token, they're taking a lot of risks.
A lot of risks.
And a lot of them are excellent. They're not all dirtbags.
Right.
A lot of them are. When you got, so you went to Ponce, Puerto mm-hmm. Rico, right?
I did.
And who was your country attaché or SAC at the time, special agent charge?
Over in Puerto Rico is Javier Pena.
There you go. You can't get away from that guy.
No. So I ended up going there and I was assigned and I was a 13. So Puerto Rico is typically a younger office. And Ponce at the time didn't have any 13s. When I arrived, a good friend of mine also arrived, who was also a 13. He came out of Pakistan. And so when you arrive, you settle in your office and then you have a meeting with the SAC. And so in that meeting, the expectations are set for you. And this is what I expect out of you come into this office, this region. So I met Javier Pena and he's super cool. We talked about Laredo where he used to work. Maybe we chatted about this and that, and he set the level of expectation and lead mentor guide and helped the younger agents. And he goes, that's all I, you know, he's been in the same positions about being threatened and he understands and take care of family first. And also help out the younger kids, make sure they don't blow themselves up and do proper cases. And so I was able to work on that.
It's amazing. Anybody that you talk to that ever worked for Javier only says good things about him. I've never heard a single person. Of course, they might not say it to me because they know we were partners for so long, still are in business. But he's very well thought of. I mean, he's a legend within DEA.
Oh, for
really
sure.
Really is.
For sure. Great guy. Great guy.
When your wife was diagnosed with an illness at some point, was that while you were in Puerto Rico?
Well, yes. So when we moved to Puerto Rico, we had our son, Alejandro, and he was born in Ponce. He's Ponceño. While my son was about 8 months old, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer and triple negative invasive ductal carcinoma. It's essentially a cancer that There's no known reason why you have it. You just have it, and it's incredibly aggressive. And if you have it, if you're diagnosed with it prior to the age of 40 years old, it's double, two times more aggressive. So it's a very serious situation. And I've ended up working in Puerto Rico just under 3 years. And Javier Pena ended up leaving and going to Houston soon after I arrived to Puerto Rico. And so I had different administrators above me, and I was able to file a medical transfer. And there are two places in the world that did treatment, top level care for my wife's cancer. One was in Houston. The other one was in Paris, France. And I didn't think DEA would see fit to send me to Paris, France. So I was able to put in, for Houston. And at the time during chemotherapy, we ended up seeing how my son, had epilepsy. And while we were having treatment, or the day that my wife was out of cancer treatment, all of it, she was signed off by the doctors. We ended up going into the hospital to take care of my son because of his epilepsy. We did 5 days for some review, and we had some doctors who unfortunately misdiagnosed him with the wrong epilepsy, gave him the wrong medicine, and it took about a year to get off this medicine. And so when I went back to Puerto Rico, I have my wife who's recovering from cancer treatment and surgery. I have my son who who is having drop down seizures. And at one point he was having a seizure every 8 minutes for 2.5 months, right? So you have this dichotomy of challenges. And DEA gave me the opportunity to be with my family and to take care of them in Virginia during treatment. And then once we were managing my wife, but more focused on our son and his epilepsy and how the medicine was there was a causation for his grander seizures that he had. I did a double medical transfer request. And from there, I was sent to Houston. And ironically, my paperwork ended up getting lost. And I'll always remember Bruce Travers. I didn't know who he was, but he was in charge of the career board. And I ended up talking to him on the phone. And then, man, that guy's a stand up. He took everything I had to say, received the paperwork. And that same day I had numbers to go to Houston. He made it happen. Yeah. And then my understanding is that during that time period, Javi was still involved and he signed on the orders for me to come over. So that's another, you know, urban legend. He was part of that as well. And so I was lucky to leave Puerto Rico, good standing, you know, managing life and kind of changing perspective of, you know, how to manage cases and wanting to stay international, but you can't with that type of family medical, and which allowed me to go to Houston and kind of put me on this new path of how to manage life.
Right. Yeah, Bruce was extremely well thought of in DEA back during his time. Sadly, lost touch with him over the years, but I mean, that's what DEA does. We try to look out for our own.
Yeah, yeah. On that time, they did. They did take care of me, and I forever appreciate that.
Yeah. So now, what year did you get to Houston? Do you remember?
2013. My first day in the office was November 1st, 2013. Well, that was the day I was supposed to show up. As I'm getting in the elevator in the hotel, my son has a grand mal seizure. My wife shouting at me. So I run back. You know, you're wearing your suit and tie for your first day. And I end up running back, go to the ER. And then so I showed up technically, accurately on November 2nd was the first day I showed up to the office in Houston.
And I'm going to guess there was no problem with that whatsoever in the DEA office.
The medical? No, they knew that I was showing up and I had a lot going on. So they were completely fine. And I was assigned to a strike force group, strike force floor, where at the time, it was part of OCDF, organized crime drug enforcement task force, where it's a joint floor. We have FBI in one corner, ATF down the hall, HSI across the way, but we're all supposed to work together. And sometimes we do. And sometimes we don't. That Strike Force 4, it kind of still had that flavor of international feel potentially. And so I was lucky to be assigned to a Strike Force group, which and my entire tenure there in Houston, it was phenomenal because they allowed me to do what I needed to do to take care of the family, and also do some interesting cases.
Was your group supervisor either Mike Chavarria or Keith Bishop?
No, but I knew Keith Bishop on that Zeta case when I was in Laredo, Texas. I met him. I remember shaking his hand. I went into the GS office, shook his hand, and his hand, it was the biggest hands I've ever, so it's like a big polar bear claw just kind of grabbing your hand. And I think he does it on purpose because he knows that he has gigantic mitts, you know? So no, I met Keith Bishop, cool dude, and Mike Chavarria. I did not work for him, but he was in the building. You know, I like Mike a lot. I think at that time he was over tech in the wire room and all of that world. He wasn't doing enforcement at the time.
Those are two more DEA legends. At one point, I was the ASAC at Special Operations Division over Mexico and Central America, and Keith was assigned to that section. And that's when I talk about him, I say the same thing you did. The man has got the biggest hands of any person I've ever shaken hands with.
It's freakishly large hands.
And if you don't know who he is, ladies and gentlemen, check him out. He used to play for this semi-pro ball team called the Denver Broncos.
I think
he was 8 years all pro. So
yeah,
big boy. But a fantastic investigator.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very smart, man. Yeah. The guy was sharp.
His work ethic was unparalleled. I mean, I could wake up in the middle of the night and I'll have text messages coming in from Keith at 3:30 in the morning, sitting in the office working on a case. I mean, you got to love people like that. Dedication's unbelievable.
You know who was there is Lee Nash.
Yeah.
And you and I talked about Lee Nash. Lee Nash, when I first arrived, was a group soup on the Strike Force floor down the way. But Lee Nash ended up, he was the guy who did my PT test when I got hired with DEA.
Wow.
And he actually did it twice, because the first time I failed my run. It was 2 weeks after I was released off my shoulder injury from that pursuit I was in. And I during when I was recuperating, other than going and do that little side gig movie, I didn't really work out that much. And so I rightfully failed. And then Lee was asked to do another group, and I ended up being in the group, and I passed. And then from there, I was able to go to the academy. So that was really cool to see him there as a GS. And later on, he left, traveled around, did headquarters time, and then he ended up coming back and becoming the ASAC over Strike Force. Then that was awesome. Great guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. I love the Strike Force. I got to build out the Strike Force in Atlanta after I left SOD. And just had, oh my gosh, and we got along with everybody. We had everybody in the central, same office space, unlike you guys across the hall and so forth. But just some butt kickers that were aggressive, and the seizures were unbelievable. The amount of meth that they were killing, they were knocking off cocaine loads. They were knocking off multi-million dollar cash loads. I remember the customs guys back then knocked off a tractor trailer that was a cattle hauler. Two-level cattle hauler on the trailer, huge, you know, like a 40-foot trailer. Mm-hmm. And in between the first and second floors was a vacant space between under the floor. And when they got the plate off of there, there was a cable. So we got a Georgia State Trooper with a four-wheel drive to hook onto those cables and pull it out. And I think it was over $12 million came falling out of the back of that. I mean, it was just, the Strike Forces I loved them. I loved them. great time, one of the best times I had in DEA. And we're coming up on the end of the first hour here, so I don't want to get into the next part because this is, ladies and gentlemen, this is where we're going to get into what he did in Houston, which is one of the most unique things I've ever heard in DEA. I'm excited for you to hear about it. I want to learn more about it because I've only gotten to scratch the surface with Chris here. But he has agreed to come back tomorrow. Just before we leave, when you retired from DEA, what year was it, Chris?
December 31st, 2024.
And what was the reason for retiring? Were you tired? Were you mandatory?
I turned 50. That's actually my birthday. New Year's Eve is my birthday.
Oh, okay.
And I turned 50, and I realized once I moved to Houston that I was no longer family first. And I learned once my son's seizures were resolved, got him off the meds, found the right doctors. My son is on the autism spectrum disorder, and my son is nonverbal. And so I realized that as hard as I was working for the government, I was able to accomplish all the professional objectives that I wanted to accomplish as a 13 investigative agent. I originally wanted to go into supervision, did all the testing, et cetera. But having family with everything we were dealing with, traveling overseas, that tempo, it's a very fast tempo, being away from your loved ones, that wasn't in the cards for me. And I realized if I've accomplished all of my objectives career-wise, why not leave at 50 when I'm eligible and take that energy that I have and dedicate it for my family and try to pursue and be advocate, start my own business, but also advocate in the world of autism full time. And that's what I've been doing. So I was able to leave, you know.
Excellent. And that's, our families are the ones that suffer the most in DEA. I know it happens in other law enforcement agencies as well, especially at the federal level. I know firsthand what it does in DEA. And I try to tell people that are interested in becoming DEA agents, this is not a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job. This is not a job. This is a lifestyle because it affects everything in your life, whether it's you're dealing with a wife that has been diagnosed with cancer, or you're dealing with a child that has a special needs issue. DEA, under certain leaders, is gracious enough to help you with your family. But the same token, you don't get a free pass. You're still expected to produce. And I'm certainly not saying anything bad about DEA. It's amazing how much DEA will bend over backwards at times to help you get through those situations. So that's why I can't say enough good things about our families. The stuff that we miss, the things that they put up with, especially our spouses. For me, we had two daughters at home at the time. The boys were already out. I thought I was doing a good job and making things and tried to be there when I could. And when I retired, they reminded me of all the things I missed. And and they weren't doing it vindictively. It's just, hey, here's how it was. And they have forgiven me, if that's the right word to use. But so our unsung heroes, that's our families. Gosh, we couldn't do this without them. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's true.
It keeps on track, right?
That's true. I agree with that for sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, I just wanted to get to that part because tomorrow we're going to get into so many things. We're going to get into this special operation he initiated in Houston. And I've got a ton of questions that deal with working undercover, with dealing with autism awareness, and what Chris is doing now. So you want to be sure and come back again. If you haven't checked out Game of Crimes yet on the Patreon side, that's patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Saw a couple of retired DEA folks sign up here the past week. Love you guys for what you do. Love your support here of the show. Chris, thank you so much for being here with us today. And thank you for agreeing to come back tomorrow, brother. It's an honor and a pleasure to have you on here.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back. Come back tomorrow. In the meantime, take care of yourself. Be safe out there. God bless.
What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.